Oh, misty eye of the mountain below. Keep careful watch of my brother's souls. And should the sky be filled with fire and smoke, keep watching over your sons.
This is A Sound That Runs in the Deep, a The Hobbit fanfic, written by Malphus and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated R, contains the pairing Feely Keely, with additional tags for pre-canon content, mutual pining, angst, hurt comfort, sibling incest, oh my god, so much pining, soulmates, happy ending. Author's notes. The timeline for this runs pre-movie to the end of an unexpected journey. Liberties taken everywhere. Don't look too closely at the Tolkien canon that has been hastily stitched together. Quote credits. I followed a sound that runs in the deep. From Murder by Death. 'Twas sunrise, 'twas the sky. From Emily Dickinson. And When Mercy Seasons Justice, from William Shakespeare. What you seek is seeking you, from Rumi. Every stone on this road, precious to me, from Stanley Kunitz.
If this is to end in fire, then we shall all burn. Watch the flames climb high into the night, calling out, Father, oh, stand by and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. High.
It need not be winter for the days to grow cold. The wind finds its way, howling through the cracks in the wood and the stone. Winter in Ered Luin is bitter and harsh, with long days and longer nights that drag the pull of snow and ice across the landscape like a cloak. Underneath heavy furs and blankets, with his brother curled against his back, Keely is warm, even with the snowstorm that beats against the mountain. 100 winters in the Blue Mountains would not make them warmer, but Keely has only 70 and has not seen enough of the world to know there are colder heights, more frigid peaks. To him, this is as cold as he's ever known. The fire in the hearth has all but died over the course of the night, but he needs no suggestion of light in order to feel the tension in his chest that winds itself tight when he thinks of the hours around him that are passing through his fingers. The sun hasn't risen, and there is not so much as a hint of light seeping from the horizon, but Keely cannot sleep. His brother's hand is curled into the fabric at his back, fingers warm like a brand, and Keely is afraid that sleep will steal this moment from him if he indulges it. There has been an ache in his heart for over 10 winters, one that he discovered 10 years ago as he lay in this very bed with his brother asleep beside him. And he has had so much time to become accustomed to the painful pull of it that ebbs and flows but does not fade. He does not need the light of the fire to know the strangeness that burns in his own chest. That is deep and endless, and overflowing like a secret he's not supposed to keep. The ache in his chest has been there for longer than 10 years, for years and years and years. And the first time he felt it was when they had lain in this very bed, and moments before falling asleep, he had told Feely his true name. The symbols had felt strange, foreign, and powerful when he had whispered them into the quiet space between them. The ache in his chest has been there since Feely echoed the name back to him, the sound rolling from his tongue heavily, and Keely's young heart had hiccuped in his chest. He knows Feely's true name, had liked the way it sounded in his mouth the first time, and the second, and the hundredth, and he still likes the way it feels, like something special between them. The ache that had started then feels bittersweet now, because those syllables may as well be etched across his skin in glowing runes for how exposed his heart feels day after day. Their mother explains to them, when they are too young to understand, that dwarves love only once. Dwarves love once, and then they do not love again, whether it be in the face of death or in the face of heartbreak. And the name on their heart cannot, will not, change. The invisible mark they carry will not erase, will not fade with time. And your one is not a promise, and it is not a truth. Your one may not love you, may not carry you in their heart as you do them, and you may not be their one. It has been more than 10 winters since Keely first woke and knew what that bittersweet poem meant. He remembers the anger and the betrayal that had felt thick in his mouth. And he remembers making himself sick with envy and heartache and loathing. Moreover, he remembers the folly of youth, of the 60 winters that had not been enough to understand, to accept the push and the pull of his heart, and how that had all culminated into rage he had misdirected at his brother. Because Feely is not perfect, has never been and will never be, but he is as close as Keely believes a dwarf is able. He wields strength and courage like twin swords at his side and under his mastery, and the blood that courses through his veins is humble and noble. Keely watches him train, watches him grow skilled, and watches him learn from his mistakes. And he watches the others around them who let themselves be consumed with doubt and pride and greed. Feely is selfless, thinks of nothing before the family he holds closest, and he is kind and strong of heart, and, though he once desperately tried to, Keely could not hate him. He thinks, in the beginning, that the fates are mistaken. Feely is his entire world, the solid in which he bases all of his life, and it would be a simple thing to mistake that devotion, that idolization, for love. Those seeds of doubt plant themselves in his mind, and they take hold, until all Keely can think is that everything is mistaken, everything is wrong. His own heart has been misled. Even at the time, he realized how silly an idea it was to think that something so powerful could be so wrong. But he clung to it all the same. Even now, there is something in the back of his mind that convinces him that it is an error, that surely the fates would not be so cruel to him as to choose his own brother. And he thinks, foolishly, wildly, that perhaps someday his heart will change. There is no age for the push and pull of destiny, no amount of time that must pass. You realize, from one moment to the next, that the shape your fate has taken is forever altered. Keely is not the youngest dwarf to find his one, nor is he the oldest. He does not speak of it, does not bring it up, and he does not cherish the privilege of knowing, as he thinks he might be able to if it were any other being, any other in all of Middle-earth who were his one. Feely stirs behind him, face pressed against Kile's back, and his closeness is warm and pleasant and terrible. Ah, 'twas sunrise, 'twas the sky, Feely mutters against his back. And Keely can hear the smile in his voice, even if he can't see it. Normally, Feely would lay beside him and keep his arms at his side, tucked up against his chest so that Keely could feel his knuckles against his back. But today is different. He slings an arm over Keely's in a loose embrace, and Keely's heart hiccups in his chest. Today is different, because today is the last for a long while that he will lay beside his brother in the warmth of their bed and greet the morning together. It's not sunrise yet, Keely says, and his voice is quiet. If it were sunrise, it would mean Feely should rise. It would mean that he should dress and grab his pack from where it lays against the wall near the door. Sunrise would mean it was time for Feely to meet their uncle, to journey into the city of men where Thorin has established himself as a trustworthy blacksmith. If it were sunrise, Keely would be saying his goodbyes. 2 seasons, Feely says, his voice equally quiet. It's not so long. Keely's chest aches, and he refuses the urge to curl his fingers around Feely's hand resting against his chest. 2 seasons is an amount of time he only has comparison for with his brother at his side, weathering through elements and hurdles alike, and he can scarcely imagine a single day without his brother's wide smile. His heart is beating in his chest, but all he hears is the rush of white noise in his ears. Like wind through the trees, like he's standing at the bottom of a waterfall. And he thinks wildly that he would give anything to not let this moment go any further. I'll barely notice you're gone, Keely says, as though on cue. But he can scarcely hear himself speak. It feels as though he's underwater and his chest is tight, his breathing choked. Feely sits up, and his movements allow an awful draft into the cocoon they've made. The cold air knocked something back into Keely. Sense, or rationale. And he blinks rapidly to clear his mind. His brother moves and tugs on Keely's arm. And Keely doesn't even have it in him to do anything but allow himself to be pulled upright. Get up, lazy bones. Braid my hair. Don't go, is all Keely can think. And he cannot open his mouth to speak, for he is certain those are the words that will leave his mouth. It shouldn't bother him, not like this, but it does. It shouldn't matter, not really, but it does. Feely slides out of bed and makes his way over to stoke the fire, but the room is uncomfortably cold. It will take time for the new logs to turn into warmth, longer still for that heat to permeate the cold mountain air. And in the meantime, they stay seated on the warm bed with the furs tucked around them. It's the way they've done things for as long as Keely can remember. for as long as they've shared everything they've owned. Feely's hair does not tangle, but is a mess all the same. It smooths in Keely's hands as he twines blonde strands between his fingers, overlapping at his knuckles as he braids them into neat, tight sections. They were both born blonde, but Keely's hair had begun to change from one summer to another. He likes the contrast between them, the lightness of Feely's hair against the tan skin of his fingers. These braids have been his handiwork since he was old enough to make his fingers perform the motions, since he was old enough to know the patterns and the meanings in braiding, in what it all means. The braids in Feely's hair have been from his hands for almost as long as Keely has had hands, and he's braided his hair 1,000 times and thought nothing of it. Everything is the same, but also not. Because the name on Keely's heart is not a mistake, but is simply a message he has never been ready to accept. The name on his heart says that he is in love, says that he has found the only one in all earth and sky he should search for. And it is difficult to understand the weight of what that means when he has had Feely to himself, without adversity or competition, for all of his life. Today is the same, but also very different, because it is today that Keely holds his brother's braids in his hair and realizes he will not see him until after the spring, until after the warm weather has come and nearly gone again, and it is not a lifetime, but it feels as though it is. Today he overlaps the strands between his fingers and he thinks, suddenly, startlingly, of the hands of another in his brother's hair. He thinks of another braiding Feely's achievements and lineage into his scalp, the strands of his hair smooth between the fingers of someone else. And it leaves a numbness in his chest and a coldness in his hands that startles him to stillness. He thinks of a day when another will sit behind Feely as he does, their knees against his hips, their elbows resting against the line of his spine. And it chokes something heavy in his throat that he cannot swallow. Feely leans back against him playfully, turning his head just enough to see him out of the corner of his eye.
Did you forget what you were doing?
Keely uses his grip on Feely's hair to turn his head back, because his mind is reeling and he cannot face his brother. Not with the open, lost look he knows must be on his face. His hands are not shaking, but they tingle with nerves and anxiety. The ringing has returned to his ears. White noise like the rush of the ocean, and time has not stopped moving around him, but it certainly feels as though it has. There is an ache in him that he almost cannot identify, because it is the first sharp pains of jealousy that have ever clutched at him so obvious and so unmistakable. His voice is steady, even if his heart is not.
For your own sake, you should hope not. What a mess you would be without me.
Feely laughs, and Keely can almost feel it underneath his fingertips. It warms him in a way he can't describe, in a way that feels from his cheeks to the tips of his toes, and a voice hisses in the back of his head, "Stop. Stop. Feely says, characteristically sincere and unabashedly honest.
Aye, that I would be.
Keely's fingers stutter in his brother's hair, like the breath in his lungs, and his mouth snaps shut. He stares at the woven strands wrapped around his fingers and feels as though he is holding pieces of his own heart in his hands. It hurts like nothing else he has reference for, and it's a pain he can't quell, can't quiet. He stares at the hand in Feely's hair, and, for the first time, accepts that he truly has fallen in love.
And if we should die tonight, we should all die together, raise a glass of wine for the last time, calling out Father. Watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. Desolation comes upon the sky.
The two seasons that Feely spends in the town of Men, honing his skills at the forge with their uncle, are two seasons that Keely spends without him. He wakes every morning to an empty room, to the cold spread of bed behind him that he is too small to warm himself, and he wakes with too much daylight to pass alone. The time is that which Keely spends without direction, without purpose, wreaking havoc upon himself and their poor mother's nerves and his own lonely heart. He spends two long seasons with black eyes and bruised knuckles in the struggle to feel something, anything, even anger and violence, other than the emptiness that threatens to overtake and bury him. He spends the time with bloodied fingertips, worn raw and painful from sleepless nights on the archery range, with a slide of bowstrings across his calluses. Targets at 100 paces, 200, 300. Whittle from challenge to naught, but the thunk of iron arrows into the wooden pieces brings him no joy. Keely takes up the bow to have something of his own, something new and dear to him that no other in his family possesses. And if it reminds him of the pull he has towards his brother, then no one has to know. There are no real archers in Ered Luin, none who prefer a bow, nor any who have honed their skill with one, and he spends countless hours on a range of his own making, breaking arrows and blisters and his own resolve. He learns how to carve a curve into his bow that has meaning, purpose, and he learns how to fletch the feathers that give his arrows flight. He learns to create and to succeed, and he does it on his own. It changes something in him that wouldn't have without Feely's absence, makes him stronger in his own person, and it makes it easier to come to terms with the piece of himself he's given away without his own permission. It doesn't ease the ache any. Feely's absence feels like punishment, as though he has done something wrong. Once, twice, a dozen times, he thinks of the longing in him that festers and worsens, and wonders whether there is any way to end it. He lays awake at night in a bed that is not the same without the breathing of someone else beside him, with his fists curled into the sheets, and he imagines that he can will away the numbness in him with enough concentration. He lies in bed and he dreams of waking to nothing, to a heart that does not ache, and wonders if it would be preferable. He wonders, a little madly, if it is common for a dwarf to wish they had not found their one. Absence does not make the heart grow fonder, but rather more desperate. Two seasons pass,
Thorin calls for him, and Keely cannot leave home fast enough. He is meant to train with his uncle, to take his place so that Thorin may see to more important business in the north, but he would have gone for any reason. Keely gives up fresh air and the familiarity of his home for the foreign of the city, for the strong smell of sulfur and iron, and he relinquishes them eagerly. 2 seasons is the length of time it takes for everything to fall back into place, but it is worth every sleepless night to be reunited with his brother. He can liken it to the sun coming from behind the clouds, or a drink of water to a parched throat, but they would be incomparable. Keely smiles so wide and for so long that his teeth ache from it. Feely's hands are in his hair, fingers briefly brushing over the engravings of the identical hammered clip there. Feely hugs him so tightly that Keely is sure there will be bruises, is sure he will ache later with it. But he clings desperately to his brother as though letting go might mean watching him slip through his fingers again. They are reunited, and it brings back the joy in his smile, the purpose in his stride, and the pulse in his veins that has felt cold and dead for too long. To be with his uncle and his brother is a blessing, a gift he does not squander, and it is someplace he feels irrevocably welcome. The days are long and hot with the heat of the forge, but the heaviness in his heart is lighter, and the days can be as long as they like. The nights are shorter and colder, but there's a fire in the hearth and a smile on his brother's face. Sometimes they spend their evenings further in town, amidst lantern light and pipe smoke and the smell of ale. Sometimes they spend their nights side by side on wooden benches, listening to raucous tales and boisterous laughter. Some nights, he feels the vibration of Feely's laugh, the grin that splits his lips, and it does more to warm Keely's chest, the edges of his cheeks, than the strong stout in his tankard. He grins himself into dark liquid with darker eyes, and he lets Feely's arm lay across his shoulders, while they listen to the men they do not know weave tale and lore out of drunken memories. The table is lively, friendly, and their newfound friends are either too drunk to notice they are dwarves or of a mind to not think it matters. The man at his left has scarcely seen 30 winters, but his face is weathered and his hair is graying. And Keely thinks it strange that he could be 44 years this man's elder and still be but a child. He has no stories to join in with, no tales, tall or not, to embellish. Bit of advice, see that you don't go looking for trouble, the man next to him says, in reference to the drunken fool almost standing upon the table in his haste to tell of the 13 bandits he fended off with only a butter knife. It'll find you sooner or later. No need to invite it along like this one. Braddock, get down, you loon! Trouble has always been Mother's nickname for you, Feely says in his ear, breath sweet like pipeweed, and Keely grins. Feely, trouble follows you wherever you go. Feely, trouble is looking for you. Not all their nights are spent with friendly strangers in their cups. Some nights they sit by themselves, tired and with dust underneath their fingernails. And Keely is exhausted, but happy. Some nights there are no friendly faces to sit with. And sometimes Feely sleeps too early, and sometimes Keely goes alone. Once or twice there is trouble, from hard-headed fools with nothing to their names to hold them back, but most of the time he is left to his own company, or welcomed to tables of wandering strangers. Humans, dwarves, who have no ire to spend on him. One night, Killy finds himself distracted, standing at the bar with his coins in his hands, eavesdropping on an herbalist's story of his trek across the Barrow Downs. He doesn't stand there long, but it's long enough that he catches the attention of someone who has too much ale in their stomach and too little sense in their head. A man, more than a head taller than himself, who is flexing his fingers like he wants to touch and letting his eyes roam like he's found his prize. If he were smarter, he would realize the dwarf he is eyeing is a handful even to those he favors, more reckless energy than any one person should want. But he doesn't know Keeley. He thinks him easy, simple, and he is wrong. He insults Keeley's people, insults the fairness of his face and the height of his bones, and the words are bitter, but Keeley has heard worse. The man asks him if he is a lass, if he would shriek like one, and Keeley knows enough about the ways of men to know it is an insult, even if he doesn't know why. If he were a dwarven lass, he would castrate this man before speaking to him, and he doesn't understand how this could be an implied slight. There is ale still in his glass, but he's lost the taste for it, and the hour is late. He moves two steps before there is a hand in his hair, curled tight in a fist, and Keeley allows himself to be pulled backward, to not cause his scalp undue strain. He flows back just far enough to grind the heel of his boot into the man's unprotected shin. The patrons around them give them space, but it's over before it begins. Keeley has no real experience, but he has years of practice and years of pent-up anger and a distaste for the arrogance in others that makes them think they have a right to everything they want. He breaks the man's nose with his forehead, cracks a rib with his foot. He busts his knuckles and gets blood on his sleeve, but the man is a crumpled heap on the floor, and it tastes a little like satisfaction. Keeley hauls the man out of the bar by his collar and leaves him laying on the street. He goes back in to pay for his drink, and then he goes home. It happens, but it's not common. Keeley weathers comments in Arid Luin and outside of it the same, because ignorance and cretinism are not divided by race or gender or region. When he is young, the words sting and he lashes out against them. But now he only lashes out when the words become violence, become threats. He is careful to keep his fighting minimal, to keep his anger in check, because he knows how the eyes and words of others can affect their standing in a town of men. Still, he is young and wild and sometimes irrational. He fights more often than he should, more often than is wise, and he doesn't have to deal with the consequences until suddenly he does. The next evening he returns home from errands and deliveries to find blood splattered across the shop counter, and the basin upstairs turned pink from the splits in Feely's knuckles. His cheek is mottled red, lip bleeding at the corner of his mouth, and he is bandaging his hand carefully and slowly. He doesn't look up when Keeley walks into the room, doesn't seem to notice the way his brother freezes in the doorway. There's a shirt slung over the back of the chair. Purple and yellow discolorations down Feely's ribcage and on the soft part of his throat. And for a moment, Keeley cannot breathe. He takes one unsteady step into the room, and Feely glances up, eyes sharp and shoulders tense for the second it takes him to realize who it is. Then his posture deflates noticeably, And he exhales slowly. "You're early," he says. And Keely doesn't feel early. He feels late, too late. He doesn't ask who, because he already knows who. He knows the smattering of men who seek out their work and then complain of the prices, of the craftsmanship, of the complacence and patience in Feely, when all they want out of him is a rise. He knows who took their chances while their uncle and he were away, when there was only a single dwarf in the smithy instead of three, and he knows them as cowards. He doesn't ask what happened, because he already knows. He knows that Feely is firm and steady like stone, impassive on his own and too passionate when his family is behind him, and that he won't throw a punch until one has been received. Keely knows that his brother will have broken their jaws and ribs, knows his hands are strong and experienced, but it's not enough. It's never enough. They'll come back. They always come back. Keely is young, and he thinks he knows everything. But in truth, he knows very little at all. "They weren't here to buy anything," Feely says, into the quiet of the room between them, and there's a curiosity to his voice. "They were looking for you." Keely recoils visibly, unable to stop himself. He feels suddenly numb, and his fingers curl so tightly into his palms that his knuckles turn white, fingernails biting into his own skin. He remembers the eyes of a drunken oaf that washed over him like a hawk might watch a field mouse, and of the rage and humiliation that the spiteful cling to. He feels sick to his stomach, angry and volatile in a way that will only lead to more consequences. "What happened last night?" Feely asks, though his eyes do not leave his task. There is no room for excuses, for dismissive responses, because there is blood on Feely's hands, on his face, and the guilt settles thickly into Keely's stomach like lead. There is a tension in Feely's movement, in the harshness of how he bandages his knuckles, and by the tone of his voice, it feels like hurt. "You said nothing when you came back." "I thought..." Keely starts, and he crosses the room to kneel beside his brother. "I thought what's done is done." And he is scarcely to one knee when Feely turns, sharp and too quick, and his fingers are tight where they curl around Keely's collar. There is still blood on his knuckles that brush across Keely's throat and make him tense in his brother's grasp. And they are close enough now that Keely can pick out all the shades of yellow and purple, modeling at the bruise on Feely's throat. He swallows thickly, around the heart in his throat. "Feely, I cannot imagine how drunk he was when he approached you last night, because this afternoon downstairs, he mistook me for you," Feely says slowly. He is angry, hands shaking, fearful, but not for himself. Keely is drowning, guilty and full of regret and shame for the marks on his brother. "I let him and his friends crawl out of here. But now that I see you, I regret my mercy." Keely feels anger in that moment that he cannot explain, that he cannot swallow. It matters not to him that he is younger, that he is without beard or battle ornaments, that he is but a child in the eyes of others. He would sooner carve out the man's eyes who put his fingers on Feely's face than allow him to ever see the sun rise again. He cannot be the reason there are bruises on Feely's person, marred onto his skin like burns. He should settle before he reveals more of his heart than is wise, but he cannot. And when mercy seasons justice? Keely asks, and he presses his thumb against the red of Feely's face. Did they show you mercy? Would they have shown me any? Do not misunderstand me, Feely says, and there is a bite to his brother's voice that he does not recognize, that burns low and hot in him without warning. I carved his hamstring out of his ankle for the ill he spoke of you. If he deigns to speak to you again, he may do so on his knees or not at all. Keely tries, but cannot calm the swell of his heart. He buries his face in Feely's shoulder, hands curled tight around his elbows, to keep himself from kissing his brother.
Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire burning the trees. And I see fire hollow in soul. I see fire blood in the breeze. And I hope that you remember.
He could be Feely's one, and the thought burns something in him that he cannot quell. Keely knows only his own heart, but he knows where it lies. He knows that if Feely asked if he had found his one, if he asked who Keely had given himself to, that Keely would tell him between one heartbeat and the next. There are nights he lays beside his brother, whether underneath the mountain or underneath the night sky, and very desperately wishes that Feely were curious enough to ask a question that shouldn't be voiced. Keely spends too many nights laying awake, imagining what would happen if Feely were to ask, if he were desperate to know. And it keeps him restless. Feely would not ask, in the same way that Keely would never. But Keely imagines it all the same. He imagines 100, 1,000 different outcomes, and he imagines too many that leave his ears pink and his eyes staring glazed into the fire. It is dangerous to let yourself become enthralled with a possibility, and Keely does not know the name his brother carries, nor truly if he even carries a name at all. Keely feels, more than ever, that he knows nothing. Their mother does not speak of the way Keely's eyes always strayed to his brother, of the longing and desperation in them. But she may yet know of it. Before they leave Eridluin, she pulls him into a tight embrace, without prompting or preamble, holds him close and says only, "What you seek is seeking you." The journey from the Blue Mountain to the Green Hills of the Shire is theirs alone, the longest they've taken on their own, and it gives Keely time, too much time, to think. His own heart is traitorous, rebellious, and he knows he looks at Feely too long, too openly, and that there is going to come a day when he does not look away in time. When Feely, not another dwarf watching the two of them, will see what he should have kept to himself. Their uncle is wise to the way Keely's footfalls have ever echoed Feely's step for step, and he has seen the length they will go to remain side by side. And he challenged it once, and now, never again.
Thorin is wise to the resolve in his youngest nephew's actions, to the fierce loyalty that will not be quelled. But it is not wisdom or experience that stays him from involving himself. Kili sees the pride in his uncle's eyes, the softness that shines on them when he thinks no one else is aware. Thorin never speaks to him of it, never once implies anything he could not take back. But there is understanding in his eyes, and acceptance in the way he stands near the hearth in Bilbo's home and says, "I am glad you both came." There are looks from the others that could mean something or nothing, and Kili does not take them to heart. He knows how easy it is to judge from a distance, to look at what you will never know and guess at how you would do things differently. And he does not blame the questioning glances and the confused stares that he suffered since childhood. There's a look in Dwalin's eyes that has been there for as long as Kili can remember. And it is knowledge and understanding and exasperation thick like coiled smoke.
"You'd think you were the first fools to fall in love,"
Dwalin says, and the hour is late, most of their kin asleep. But Kili starts regardless.
"Don't look so guilty all the time."
Kili's face flushes, angry, and the denial is automatic. I don't...
Dwalin huffs out a laugh, humorless. "Save your breath, lad. Been watching you make eyes at him for as long as you've had eyes. I ain't about to start lecturing you now."
The den is quiet, just the glow of the hearth and the drift of smoke from Dwalin's pipe. And there is a cacophony of snores from the surrounding rooms. Kili leans forward towards the fire, rests his elbows on his knees, and scrubs the palms of his hands against his face. There is a knot in his stomach that will not settle, but he has known Dwalin all his life, and it is the trust he has in him that keeps him from bolting from the chair he is sitting in. Trust to say nothing. Trust not to speak too hastily. Trust to understand. Kili pulls his hands away from his face and staples his fingers, casting a glance at where Dwalin is tapping his pipe thoughtfully. He purses his lips, and he's not annoyed, not truly, but he is unsettled and anxious, and it makes his words more brittle than they should be.
"Then why bring it up now?"
"Because," Dwalin says, drawing the words out slowly, like he thinks Kili's brain addled.
"You might just be old enough now to finally listen to a bit of advice. All knows you never had before."
When he was a child, Kili's first instinct, half-formed and scarcely thought through, had been the only one he had ever needed. The first words in his mouth were the ones to leave his lips, the first ideas the ones he followed through on, and he had been reckless with youth and careless with naivety. It had been nothing to tell Fili of everything, to drag his brother down every ravine and through every stream, until the day Kili had woke to a name on his heart and a secret born between them. Because Keely's first instinct would have been to tell Fili that he was his one, to tell him of the aching in every bone in his body the longer they are apart. And Kili has since learned to think his own recklessness through. Keely's first instinct now is the harshness of a rebuttal that wants to ask what advice he could take to heart on the unchangeable, on the irreversible. His first instinct is bitterness, his denial. His second instinct is to still the bristling of his spine, the tension that is weaving down from his neck in waves, and to bite his own tongue. He is learning.
Go on, then, Thrallin says, and he gestures at Keely with one hand and a wry smirk.
Let me hear it. What could old Dwalla know about love?
The same as any dwarf, I imagine. Just had a bit more of the worst parts of it. Keely's brow furrows, expression softening slightly. He wants to imagine what could be worse than loving your own kin, than the ache in his chest that never ceases. But there is some part of him that already can. There are nights he wakes in a cold sweat, feeling his name on the tip of his tongue, but no words leaving his lips, and he is desolate and empty and lost. There are nights he imagines Feely's cold, callous stare. Rejection. And there are nights he imagines Feely's stare cold and dead. His hair matted in blood. And Kitty cannot breathe. He knows there are worse things than silent suffering.
Aye, you know,
Dwalin says, gesturing at Keely with his pipe, and there's a humorless smirk on his face.
You find love and it feels like a forge burning in you, hot and dangerous and right. Sometimes looking ain't enough, though. Sometimes you reach into that fire and it burns you, flesh from bone, and you're never the same after that, are you? I know what it's like to feel that flame, laddie. To know as sure as the day you are born that your feelings are not returned.
Keely swallows thickly around the myriad unwanted emotions gathering in his throat.
I know all too well what it is to love, Dwalin says, and his voice is bitter and bare.
He pauses for a moment, and his eyes flicker briefly, automatically, to the hallway that leads to the rest of their sleeping company. It is a blink, nothing more, and then his gaze is back upon Keely. But Keely understands more in that movement than he thinks is intended. He thinks of loyalty and brotherhood, and the desolation that comes with knowing the only one who you will ever love has given their heart to another. There is a name in Dwalin's mind that Keely cannot see, that he will not ask about out of respect and admiration, but he doesn't really need to, regardless. There is pain in Dwalin's eyes, and there is a dwarf in his heart who Keely knows loves another. Mr. Dwalin, Keely manages, throat tight, and it is all he can think to say. He feels young in that moment, young and inexperienced and lost. Dwalin purses his lips, clasps Keely firmly on the shoulder, and says,
take a bit of advice from someone who knows. If you loved another, you would know it as sure as you know the beating of your own heart.
Same confined in mountain holes, we got too close to the flame, calling out Father, oh, hold fast and we will watch the flames burn open on the mountainside.
All his life, Keely has shadowed his brother. But Dwalin's words make him aware of the reciprocation of Feely's own shadowing in a way he has taken for granted. Thorin comes to them, not for one, but for two, and they need not so much as glance at one another to be in unison in their echoed loyalty. They join this quest as two, just as they've done everything as two. The presence of the others does not make him reconsider his place at Felia's side,
nor does it make Feely hesitate before leaning in, on the verge of too close, to whisper something to him that no one else can hear. They run for their lives more often than not, across open plains and tall grass, and it is Feely who shadows every step he takes. A mountain tears itself in two in order to separate them, and it is Feely who screams his name until he is hoarse, until Keely is again within arm's reach. A crooked blade trails in front of Keely's face, twisted like a sneer and sharp with promise. Start with the youngest, they say, and two, three goblins can't hold Feely back. The world around them goes up in flames, and Keely cannot speak over the terror weighing against his tongue. But he needs say nothing for Feely to follow him from the tree to the rush of battle. You would know if he loved another. Dwalin had sworn, and Keely's stomach is in knots. There is a sea of gold and jewels in the distance, in a mountain theirs by birthright, but Keely's treasure is in the light in his brother's eyes, and he desires nothing more. Never have they discussed this, but Keely knows that Feely must have a one. For years, Keely has kept his silence, and he has not asked, but neither does Feely. If he were wiser, or if he trusted his heart more, he might think on why that is. He might think about why his brother might hide his own, close and quiet, like a secret where before there had been none. If Keely were wiser, he might think back to that day in Ered Luin, when he was 7 years younger and just learning what it meant to fall in love. And he might consider the strangeness of brothers sleeping curled so close. He might consider whether Feely had thought in that moment, I cannot live without you. He tries to keep his heart from his sleeve, from the brightness in his eyes, and he pretends that nothing has changed. He pretends for a long time, but there has never before been so much at stake. There is too much adrenaline in his veins that strums low and deep without an enemy to fight, leaves him feeling wrecked and aimless and strange. There are trees around them, and the night sky above, and they are alive. But Keely's hands are shaking with the memory of soaring through the air, of leaping from the trees, of the sword in his hand. There is too much adrenaline in his veins, and he should find something meaningless to occupy him, should sharpen his sword or fletch new arrows, but instead, he stares at Feely's empty bedroll until his entire body is restless with pent-up energy. Beaufort gives him a nod when he leaves the camp, when he takes his sword and brushes past low-hanging branches and foliage. It's a reckless idea to follow his brother in a moment when they both need peace as desperately as they need companionship, but he can't occupy his mind with anything else. He thinks of the scrapes on Feely's face, of the reflection of fire and fear in his eyes, and he needs to see him. He needs to feel his pulse, wants to curl his fingers into his hair and forget himself, forget reason, and he's not paying attention, not watching anything but leaves underfoot, and he almost runs into Feely. His brother steadies him by his arm, brows knitted in concern, and his hands on Keely's skin feel like brands. There's a hiccup in his breathing as he staggers a single step, and Feely's worry is palatable between them. Keely cannot get the images out of his head of his brother running breathless beside him, of the trees in flames and falling out beneath them, of Feely's hand digging into his arm so tightly on the back of an eagle. And he cannot leave. He can't stop thinking about how he thought it was over. That they were all going to die on that cliffside. And all he wants is to feel his brother's heartbeat under his hands. Keely, what has... Feely starts. And it's been more than 7 years since Keely realized he had fallen in love. More than 2 decades since his heart chose its one. And he cannot keep doing this anymore. He braces the tips of his fingers into the soft skin of Feely's neck, tugging his brother forward, and Feely is alive, his pulse racing underneath Keely's hands, when their teeth clash together and Keely kisses him. He thinks, remembers desperately of Dwalin's words of, "You would know if he loved another," and 2 decades is not a long time to hold a secret when there are dwarves among them who have held them for a century. Feely's hands are clean as they wind in his hair, as Feely moves against him between one breath and the next. Keely thinks that it should not be this easy, that everything should not fall so neatly into place, but it does. Feely does not hit him, does not recoil in disgust, does not look at him with sad eyes and sadder regrets. Feely doesn't hesitate, doesn't stiffen underneath his touch, but presses himself along the lines of Keely's body like he's anchored there by his mouth. It feels like finding something lost, like a part of himself knitting back together, and he wonders how anyone could value gold, gems, jewels over this. He wonders desperately how he has managed without it. Keely breaks apart from him long enough to murmur his name against his mouth. His true name, in a rolling of Khazdulian syllables, and the vibration of it pulls heat in Keely's stomach. Teeth nip at his lips, before Feely's mouth finds his again, and Keely isn't sure who pushes first, just that one of them goes to their knees and the other follows, always follows. And then they're both in the dirt and leaves together. Keely kisses his brother again and again. Because he can. Because he wants to. And because that's okay now. It's nothing but okay. Feely's mouth is warm. Tastes like the river and like nothing at all. And he feels like what Keely has always adamantly known as home. A knee presses between his own, nudges his leg just enough to unsettle his balance, and then Feely is straddling his thighs and trying to turn him inside out with his tongue. His fingers are going to leave bruises on Keely's skin, where they dig in desperately and where he is not so carefully tugging at the belt around his waist, but it isn't painful. Keely's body is on fire, his mind swimming and clouded, and he couldn't even begin to... doesn't want to ever stop. "You are the loudest dwarf I have ever known. How did you possibly keep this a secret?" Feely asks against his jaw, against the marks he is leaving down his throat. He pulls back momentarily, and his eyes are an open book. "You had to have known you could have told me. You could tell me anything, and I would never..." "Don't even start," Keely bites back, and it's ridiculously easy to wind a leg around Feely's waist and roll his brother over. His braids are coming undone, and his hair is a mess, and he's breathtaking. Not just like this, but always. "You could have trusted me, and you didn't." Keely's knees hurt from where they're digging into the ground on either side of Feely's hips, from the way his muscles are tensed tight and anxious, and he cannot stay still. Whatever good the river did is being undone. They're both in the dirt, leaves clinging to their hair and clothes. There's blood on Keely's arms from retrieving arrows from goblins, and there's grime underneath his fingernails from clinging to tree branches. And Feely smells clean like river rocks, but he's not anymore. They're breathing uneven, hands and mouths desperate, and Keely realizes, when he slides his knees down and slots their hips together, they're both hard. "You're insufferable," Feely gasps into his mouth. And if Keely didn't think this tunic were his brother's only remaining one, he would tear it from his body rather than waste more time trying to undo lengths and lengths of laces. "You insolent ass! You didn't trust me either!" "Well, I'm trusting you now." And he manages to slide his fingers underneath the waistband of Feely's breeches, nails blunt against the dip in his hips, pressing against the edge of his pelvic bone. Feely's breath catches when Keely's hand wraps around him, when the careful tightening of his fingers bleeds a moan out of him. And Keely knows he's going to pay for the smug smile on his face, but for now, he presses it into Feely's neck. "That's got to come for something, eh?" Feely swears, low and guttural in the back of his throat in Kuzdal, and his ankles hook around Keely's, and he arches his body into his. It's almost painful, the angle and the way their bodies are aligned, but it's also good, in a way he doesn't have any reference for. There are hands in dark hair then, tugging him up into another open-mouthed kiss, and there's the taste of copper, someone's lip cut, and then there's a knee pressed into his thigh, his hair pulled roughly to one side, and Feely uses the momentum to roll them over again. "They're going to come looking for us," Keely manages, curling his fingers into Feely's hips as his brother undoes both their laces. He feels the leather sliding over his hip bones, down his thighs, and that, with the scrape of Feely's fingers, makes him ache. He means it as a warning, but not as a suggestion of stopping, and his brother doesn't take it from one regardless. "Something I'm sure they'll regret," Feely agrees. And his lip is bleeding, but he's also smiling, affectionate and fond and a challenge all at once. And this is all he's wanted, is it not? To have Feely look at him with nothing hidden between them, without the lingering thought that his heart can be broken between one moment and the next. Because it's been years of keeping this part of himself hidden, of trying not to turn brief touches into caresses, to bury his face in his brother's shoulder and not his neck. And now, he doesn't have to. Because he smiles back at Feely, bright and open, and pulls him back in for another kiss. He wants to kiss Feely for the rest of the night, for the rest of their lives. It would be easy for Keely to flip them again, to dig his knees into the ground and push his brother onto his back. But he doesn't. He likes Feely's way to stride him, likes that he's taller but not necessarily stronger, and he likes the glassy look in Feely's eyes when he bucks up against him impatiently. There are better places to do this, better places to spend your first night with your one. But they are young and reckless, and not bound by the stuffy traditions of older dwarves. Keely has waited forever already. It is difficult to read his brother's expression in the dark, without the glow of a campfire on them. But Keely imagines it is reflecting his own complacent one back at him. The feeling of Feely's jaw, his cheek, his neck underneath his trailing thumbs is exhilarating, sets his heart racing, and this is vastly different from the camaraderie he spent what feels like forever learning to be not quite satisfied with. It has always meant something to Keely, always meant more than perhaps it should. But now it's his to have, and it feels like finding something he's been searching for his entire life. "I know you like the back of my hand, but I feel as though I'm seeing you for the first time," Kivi says. Because he understands. Because the twitch of impatience in Feely's muscles, in the way he watches Keely's mouth form words, instills a wildness in him that is incomparable, uncontrollable. Because he understands what it means to want someone with every fiber of your being until it threatens to split you in two. What wasted time we've spent, Feely. Not wasted, Feely says, adamant. And he leans forward and catches Keely's parted mouth with his own. Every stone on this road we have walked is precious to me. He twines his fingers into blonde strands, his bare wrists against his brother's face, and his heart beats quickly against his ribcage, and for once, it is from something exciting rather than something terrifying, something ominous. Someone could come looking for them, but they don't. The devil they know is behind them, and the devil they don't is ahead. But not until morning. And if they've earned anything, they've earned the right to take this moment while they can. There is a heaviness overhead that will settle again at the first break of dawn, when they realize the road stretches farther than they've come. But it can wait until then. The end.
Inside the mountain, I see fire burning the trees. I see fire hollow in soul. I see fire blood in the breeze, and I hope that you remember me. And if the night will